ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Welcome to another episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Daily Maverick business and financial journalist Ray Mahlaka. Here's what's coming your way. Another week, another blow to independent media. We send out an SOS.
You know, there's been a jobs bloodbath in the media industry. I mean, since COVID lockdown times, we've lost a lot of journalists and media practitioners because print publications and online publications have closed down. Daily Maverick estimated that since COVID lockdowns, we've lost about 50% of jobs in the media industry.
Comparing apples and pears, literally. The Competition Commission warns fresh produce wholesalers to stop its anti-competitive practices. Later, Ray Mahlaka tells us why he believes Transnet is about to stage the biggest turnaround in business history. And women in Soweto are saying, "Funk it, I'm walking." But first, it was a lavish affair, but now the real work begins. Now that the presidential inauguration is behind us and the fight for cabinet positions continues, we look at how the markets have responded to the government of national unity, President Ramaphosa's second term, and discover everyone from industry to ratings agencies believe we're finally on a road to recovery.
It's one of my favorite people to chat to, Ray. Always a pleasure. How have you been?
Good, thanks, Liz. We were just talking off air about how crazy this election cycle has been. And we're sort of nearly through to the end of it, hey?
Yes, yes. So last week was the big day. We saw the presidential inauguration and it was, of course, a sparkly affair. You have your dignitaries and you have the military band and airplanes flying past and everyone loves watching all of that. But I'm actually more interested in what this all means for the country in the long term. It seems like the South African markets reacted positively to Ramaphosa's clinching another term. What have the markets shown in the days following Inauguration Day?
So it's not only the JSE that was really positive to Ramaphosa re-election, but we've also seen the Rand as well reacting positively. At some point, we saw the Rand going below the 18 Rand per dollar level. And these are levels that we saw in July last year. And I think most investors are optimistic that Ramaphosa has secured a second re-election, even under a government of national unity, because Ramaphosa being there for the second time essentially means that there might be a continuation of economic policies and there might be business-friendly policies that the government might implement. So most investors believe that there is now certainty and a continuation of policy as well. And there won't be any nasty surprises going forward.
Yes, absolutely. And we know, as you've hinted, that the markets have always liked Ramaphosa. And I think business and investors are definitely also liking the idea of the government of national unity taking shape. But how confident would you say the business sector is in this GNU actually being a success?
Well, there's been a sigh of relief, actually, because the political parties that have come together under a GNU, these are political parties that seem to have a respect for rule of law, have respect for the constitution, whereas the MK party, one of its manifesto pillars was to scrap the constitution. And the fact that it's not part of the GNU, a lot of investors are very happy about that because most investors typically invest in countries where there is rule of law and the constitution is respected.
And JP Morgan also double upgraded SA Asset, saying the GNU was likely the best outcome for our economy. And it upgraded SA from underweight to overweight. And from what I can gather, not being a finance expert myself, being overweight in this instance, in economic terms, is actually a good thing. Could you quickly explain to us what this latest upgrade actually means?
South Africa is rated as junk status by most credit rating agencies. South Africa was placed under junk status from the Zuma years. So what that meant is that credit rating agencies were essentially nervous about South Africa's economy and the ability of the government to be able to pay back debt on time, because the economy wasn't performing very well and public finances have been under pressure in South Africa. And the upgrade by credit rating agencies means that they feel optimistic that conditions might be improving. The electricity situation is a bit better. Transnet seemingly has a turnaround. So all of these factors might result in public finances actually being good and allowing the government to be able to pay back its debt. So the upgrade by credit rating agencies means that they are now considering maybe to remove us out of being in junk status. But that all depends on whether the government can really move fast with economic reforms, such as completely ending load shedding, growing the economy, and actually getting our logistics operations working again under Transnet.
Yes, and we'll be chatting about Transnet in a short bit. But I also want to touch on the cabinet that's yet to be formed. In last week's episode, Queenan and I discussed potential decisions around cabinet appointments. And she said that we will likely still have Enoch Godongwana as finance minister, purely because it's a portfolio that you really don't want to mess with unnecessarily. So do you predict the same in that regard? And which other portfolios would you say investors are keeping a really close eye on?
I agree with my colleague Queenan. I mean, the public finance ministry is so important. Whatever policy decisions that are implemented by the government broadly, by cabinet, this is where the funding mechanisms will now work to implement those policies. But the problem here is that within the ANC, the talent pool is so shallow. I can't think of anybody besides Enoch Godongwana who is respected, is credible, has institutional memory and knowledge, and who is liked by financial markets and investors. Someone who's seen as having a stable hand when it comes to policy. Beyond ANC circles, I don't see anybody beyond Godongwana or someone who is ready to replace him. Maybe David Masondo, the deputy under the previous administration. And I know the ANC under a GNU government would want someone who is appointed as the finance minister. I think other positions that are important to look out for in the coming days or weeks is the economic cluster broadly in cabinet. It compiles of the finance ministry, public enterprises ministry, Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, as well as the Small Business Ministry. Under the previous administration, there were talks that the Department of Public Enterprises might be completely scrapped and the various state-owned enterprises would move into their line ministries. So an Eskom, for example, would move under the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy. A Transnet would be moved and overseen by the Department of Transport. It's interesting to see what kind of ministerial posts and cabinet decisions that a GNU government will end up coming up with. So I'm really looking forward to what decisions will be made in the economic cluster of cabinet.
Beeld, Rapport, City Press, Daily Sun and Soccer La Duma. Some of these print publications have been around since the 70s and have played a pivotal role in chronicling the many historical events throughout South Africa's turbulent history. But come September this year, their voices, in print form at least, will go silent as Media 24 has announced the closure of these household titles. It serves as yet another reminder of just how vulnerable the country's fourth estate has become, and begs the question, who will save independent media?
While the economy as a whole seems a bit more bullish, the same can't be said for our media industry, unfortunately. And as we've seen last week on the 18th of June, Media 24 confirmed a rumor that many of us within the industry have been hearing for a while, and that is that several print publications will be closing up shop for good. Now that, along with the sale of its logistics company On the Dot, amounts to about 800 people directly affected by this, which is just unimaginable. Especially in these difficult times. For me, having worked at Media 24 as well, it was a real gut punch for me, but also for journalism as a whole.
You know, there's been a jobs bloodbath in the media industry. I mean, since COVID lockdown times, we've lost a lot of journalists and media practitioners because print publications and online publications have closed down. Daily Maverick estimated that since COVID lockdowns, we've lost about 50% of jobs in the the media industry. And that's even before taking account of what happened at Media 24 days ago. So this is not a good sign for media. Media is really in a tough position right now, because if more media titles close down, what does it mean for democracy? How will media play its fourth estate role of keeping society in check, holding those in power to account? The closure of more media outlets will basically mean that democracy will be compromised at the end of the day.
You know, while these various print titles will continue in digital form, as Media 24 has said, I mean, it can't be denied that our newsrooms are being hollowed out. As you've said, up to 50% of jobs have been lost within the media industry. And I think we will definitely begin to see the impact of this deepening crisis in the months to come, as institutional knowledge is already really thin. I believe the media's ability to uphold our democracy will suffer greatly. And I think a lot of colleagues have stated the same. And I read a great piece by MoneyWeb editor Rijk van Niekerk, in which he says that many corporate role players were mostly unaware of the financial difficulties faced by the media industry when he spoke to them. But as soon as he mentioned it, they realized that the downfall of independent media means serious trouble for the country. So do you perhaps see the private sector becoming more involved in pulling local journalism back from the brink?
Maybe a blind spot in media is that we as media practitioners haven't really communicated our challenges to the public. Maybe that is the reason why we find ourselves in this predicament. But, you know, the problems have actually intensified circa 2009. During the state capture years, a lot of people were donating money to media organizations. But around Ramaphosa presidency and the commitment to clean up all the acts of corruption and wrongdoing resulted in people and companies and corporates believing that corruption would end, that the media's role sort of ended with exposing state capture. But corruption is still there. There are still elements of state capture happening right now in government and the public sector. So now more than ever, we need a thriving and healthy media organization that will hold power to account. So maybe now with this SOS call, with more stories about media organizations facing financial difficulties, maybe now we might get the attention of people who might help donate to media or fundraise for media.
I want to kind of just end this segment with Rijk's final words in his piece. And I think it encapsulates really what we're trying to say today as well. And he writes, "I urge you, our valued community and stakeholders, to consider the gravity of this situation. Support local journalism. Advocate for fair advertising practices and engage with media entities to ensure a vibrant and sustainable media landscape." And that is really what we're all hoping for and what we all want to protect in South Africa. So here's hoping this, as you've stated, this SOS, so to speak, serves as a warning to everyone that something needs to change, because we cannot continue on this trajectory that we're on at the moment. Following months of complaints from consumers, farmers, and others within the fresh produce wholesale market regarding transparency and pricing, the Competition Commission launched a formal inquiry to seek clarity on three things: whether the supply chain of fruits and veg is effective and fair, how producers could be better protected against unfair business practices, and why several smaller fresh produce suppliers are seemingly locked out of the retail market. And if you think this doesn't impact you, the consumer, think again. Now, times are certainly tough, as we've just acknowledged, and fresh produce farmers have especially felt it in recent years. But a recent inquiry into the fresh produce market painted a clear picture of exactly where the wholesale fresh produce market is failing farmers, and by virtue, you know, the consumer, of course. I, for one, can certainly attest to some of the findings in the Competition Commission's report, the main one being that the pricing of fruits and vegetables is not transparent. So I have no idea what I'm supposed to pay for potatoes or what I'm supposed to pay for apples. But the commission also highlighted the slow progress in helping small and medium enterprises access the wholesale and retail markets. Can you walk us through this report and why it's so important?
So over a couple of months, the Competition Commission has been receiving complaints from the public about why is food becoming expensive? And I guess the Competition Commission decided to implement a fresh produce market inquiry looking at the architecture of food pricing and what are the factors that determine food prices, because there's a whole long chain when it comes to the production of food and the selling of food. So it starts with the farmer, then the retailer comes on board by buying the food from the farmer, and the retailer then prices the food to us, the consumer. Now, a lot of people are complaining that the many petrol price increases over the past 2 years or so have resulted in food prices becoming expensive. And we do know that there is a direct relationship between petrol price increases and food price increases as well. But what the Competition Commission has found is that even at a retail level, food prices are quite high, and how pricing of food is determined is not transparent enough. So there were instances of food being marked up or priced quite high, higher than the cost of actually getting food to the grocery store and to the consumer at the end of the day. So it really lifted the lid on how food is priced in South Africa.
And there was one section for me as well that really I found interesting, but shocking if it's true. The inquiry found that Simba, a subsidiary of PepsiCo, allegedly hoarded high quality potato seeds to ensure no one else in the market could grow similar varieties of potatoes. And that was such an interesting part of it, because that's not even something you think about. So that was really interesting for me. And it sort of made me question which other parts of the fresh produce sector is doing something similar. And how is that impacting what we pay for our fresh produce? But also how many farmers who really, really want to be a part of this industry are being locked out because of practices like this?
Not only that, at a very basic level, I worry about what impact does this have on nutritional food and access to quality nutritional food that is also affordable. So for me, this cuts across nutrition. Can we possibly be making food much cheaper and more accessible to people? So if the competition dynamics are not leveled and the playing field is not leveled, this will have quite a dire impact on nutrition and access to healthy food at a very affordable price as well.
There seems to be a big cleanup at South Africa's struggling rail, port and pipeline company. Just this past weekend, Transnet issued disciplinary charges against National Ports Authority CEO Pepi Silinga for her alleged involvement in a 300 million rand tender to upgrade a fence at the port of Kura. A number of other managers at the Port Authority are also expected to face similar charges. Meanwhile, the state-owned enterprise continues to fill executive seats, the latest being new Chief Operating Officer Solly Letswalo. So, what does this all mean? According to Ray, this could very well be the turning point Transnet investors have been waiting for.
I want us to move on to Transnet. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, and in last week's show, we chatted about Transnet and how two of its ports were rated the worst in the world by the World Bank, and Transnet said the World Bank got it wrong and that things are actually looking really good for the state-owned enterprise. And it seems there might be some truth to that statement, because you recently wrote that, quote, Transnet could stage one of the greatest turnarounds in business history. Now, when I first saw that headline, I thought, wow, Ray, that is quite a statement to make. But you base it on two things, and I want to get into the first one, is management. What is it about the recent appointments that we've seen, because we've just seen the COO also being appointed? What is it about these recent appointments that instills so much confidence?
So there have been several changes within Transnet, especially at a leadership perspective, because there is a new CEO, there is a new COO, there is a new Chief Financial Officer, CFO, and the Freight Rail Division also has a CEO, a new CEO. And the difference this time is that all of these roles were filled by internal people, people who have worked in Transnet for years. They've worked through the ranks and they know Transnet very well. They know where the problems are at Transnet and they know how to probably fix those problems. And the second is that a lot of the customers in business who rely on Transnet to move their goods to markets, such as the mining sector, are actually very optimistic about the various changes that are happening within Transnet. So I spoke to several business contacts and business leaders, and they said that they are getting a renewed sense of energy that the new management at Transnet is committed to fixing the problems at Transnet with the rail operations and the logistics operations. And they are getting a sense that things are finally turning around from within Transnet. So basically, the article was based on those two big factors.
Another point that you highlighted is that Transnet has essentially pushed out deadlines on some of its biggest loans. There's talk of about 100 billion rands in debt being deferred to give Transnet some breathing room. But this made me think, okay, so they're making this big turnaround, but isn't this just delaying the inevitable?
You're making the right observation. You're asking the right questions, because essentially Transnet is kicking the can down the road by deferring the repayment of debt. So it's really buying more time, and eventually doing so will really catch up with Transnet at a later perspective. But what Transnet is trying to do right now is to improve its operations, generate more money so that it builds up revenue and potentially generate a profit. And once it has built and improved its operations, then later on, it might be able to repay that debt. So all what Transnet is wanting and doing here is to buy more time and space to fix the problems, raise more money so that when eventually those debt payments come up at a later stage, then Transnet might be in a much stronger financial position to be able to pay back that debt. So all Transnet is doing is kicking the can down the road to buy more time and space.
Ask any South African and they'll most likely say they don't feel safe walking the streets, day or night. But one non-profit organization is working to reclaim the streets from criminals, and they're doing so 1 5-kilometer walk at night in Soweto at a time.
Let's get on to our green shoot. It's sort of a green shoot, but it's a reflection on the sad state of safety in South Africa. So last week, I came across this awesome nonprofit organization called Funk It, I'm Walking. And their motto is, let's walk to freedom. And it aims to make it safer for women to walk any time of the day or night in any part of the country. And that through providing safety for women, you unlock the economic value of safety. It's such a great campaign, and it's really getting women to stand up and claim back their space in society.
It is, and we know that we live in a very dangerous and violent country as well for women and children. So doing something as basic as a woman, I can't imagine. It brings a safety concern. Am I going to be safe when I walk the streets? Or do something as basic as jogging and running in the morning? So this is really an initiative that really warmed my heart.
It's also not just about walking purely for the sake of walking, but I also love the whole concept around women empowerment that they bring into this, because they have a bunch of great events that they host each month. There's hashtag First Thursdays, where women go on a night patrol, so to speak, through Soweto, and they support local establishments as they do so. So they go past restaurants, they educate the community about community safety. But then there's also, and this is the one I really love, there's also the 100 by 100, I'm not quite sure how you say it, where women are able to walk with a mentor or someone they find inspiring. And then it's a 5-kilometer walk, and then they exchange knowledge and stories and experiences. And in that way, they reclaim their right to walk freely at night. But then they also empower each other by helping each other unlock their potential, really, by sharing stories and life lessons.
And it's also about building community as well. As humans, I think we are social beings. But also, South Africa does not really have a strong nighttime economy because of safety concerns. So if we can get safety concerns addressed, that might even unlock a nighttime economy, because my biggest bugbear is that most amenities in South Africa shut down by 6 p.m. and 7 p.m., whereas in other countries, the economy keeps pumping even at midnight. So this initiative really has the opportunity to really unlock a thriving nighttime economy, especially for South Africa.
Absolutely. Ray, this has been such a fantastic chat. Thanks as always for really helping us understand some of the political developments, I think, in rands and cents terms, because I think that's often what's lacking. So thank you again for bringing those insights. I always appreciate it, and it brings such depth to these stories that we follow. So thank you very much.
Always lovely to be with you, Liz.
Awesome. Have a safe and happy week.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.